Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Carl Nicely, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you very much, John and Ann, and I would like to thank the committee for inviting me to be up here and be part of this 50th anniversary. It's just tremendous, just tremendous. When I said that my name was Carl Nicely and I'm an alcoholic, to the alcoholics in this room, I really wouldn't need to say anything else. I could say that, go back down, sit down in that chair, and you all would know me very well. While our experiences may differ, our basic conditions are the same. So by saying to you that I'm an alcoholic, I really don't have to go into any great story. You know pretty much about that. However, if I would make that statement, my name is Carl Nicely and I'm an alcoholic, at the PTA meeting, I bet you my chances of being president would go right down the tube. And you wonder, why would that be? Well, my experience tells me, I don't know about you, my experience tells me that most everybody outside of our fellowship are very expert on what we are. I don't know anybody that doesn't have a definition for what an alcoholic is. And I've said in my talks before, and I'll say it again tonight, we can go out into Sarnia, Port Huron, Toronto, any town we want to tonight, stop 10 people at random, ask them their definition of an alcoholic, and I will wager we're going to get 10 different definitions, because everybody knows what we are. Joe and I arrived at your doorstep 23 years ago. I wasn't any different than that either. I mean, I knew I had a drinking problem. I mean, the problem's too big to ignore. I mean, I had a serious drinking problem. But I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. And because I knew what an alcoholic was, and I had a set of criteria that you had to meet in order to be an alcoholic. I didn't meet any of that criteria, so I couldn't be an alcoholic. I was a problem drinker, of course. But I would also, if you'd stand there and listen, I'd point out, yes, I have a problem with drinking. I also have a problem with my wife. I have a problem with kids. I have a problem with money. I have a problem with my job. I have problems with social. Now, if I can just get those problems straightened out, this drinking problem's going to go away. See, because in those days, I'm talking about being as honest as I was capable of being in those days. See, I believed in those days that all alcoholics were on Skid Row. And I've since learned from you that only about 3 to 5% of us will ever get to Skid Row. And there's a very good reason for that, John. We generally will die off first. I suggest to you tonight that our brothers and sisters are on the various Skid Rows around the world are the lucky ones or the strong ones, because most of us never going to make it. I mean, we'll wind up in a penal institution or a mental institution, or someone will be playing sad songs and putting flowers around us, but something is going to interrupt our journey to Skid Row. However, I believed in those days if you weren't on Skid Row, couldn't be an alcoholic. I also believed in those days that alcoholics didn't have jobs. Well, I had a job. I was hanging by a thread, but I had this job, and I would point to it with great pride. And I also believed that alcoholics didn't have families. I had a family. Well, sort of. I mean, we lived in the same house, got our mail at that address. You see the thing that you go through, and I said this before, I say it again. Alcoholics dress funny. You go to any major city in North America tonight and you're going to see the man or woman I'm about to describe to you. They wear tennis shoes. A high top and a low top tennis shoe. Both for the left foot. But it doesn't matter. They hold their pants up with a rope belt. And they wear an overcoat a couple of sizes too big. And they wear it 12 months a year. They sleep in doorways or old cars, and periodically they will drink something out of a brown paper bag. See the picture? I wasn't that. Hell, when I came in this program, I didn't even own tennis shoes. I mean, you see the picture. Skid Row, rope belt, tennis shoes, no job, no family, no... See, that was my idea of an alcoholic, and I did not fit that criteria, so how in the name of God could I possibly be an alcoholic? So I would come to this meeting, and I would sit there, and I would parrot what you would say. You would say, my name is Ann, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm happy to be here, and I would say the same thing. My name is Carl, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm happy to be here. And I was telling you the truth on two of the three things I was admitting to you. I was giving you my correct name, and I was happy to be here. But I wasn't one of those. And as a matter of fact, I had some very serious suspicions about a number of you. Because none of you looked like I thought alcoholics looked. This went on for 6 months. And see, I was afraid to say, well, my name's Carl, I'm a problem drinker, okay? I was afraid you'd say, okay, that's fine, Carl. Why don't you go to the problem drinkers meeting? I didn't know if those guys had meetings. And I've learned, yes, they do. They're having one tonight. Any saloon you want to go into. Big meeting going on right now. But I was up there, and I would parrot this. And I knew I was missing something. I knew I was missing something because I would leave those meetings because you were forcing me to lie to you. I didn't want to lie to you, but you were making me. Making me admit to something I didn't believe that I was. And then you really complicated my life because you said, look, Carl, if you're going to make any progress here, you're going to have to get honest with yourself. Now, how can I do that? How can I do that? I'm admitting to something I don't believe that I am. You know, my group, the East German group, has an old group and a lot of long-term sobriety in there. You know, and after the meetings, I would say to some of these old-timers, I'd say, what is an alcoholic? I mean, give me a definition I can understand so that when I say I am an alcoholic, I know what I'm talking about. And I would get answers like this. These are all good answers, you understand. But it didn't help me at this battle I'm having inside of admitting to something I didn't believe that I was. I'd say, well, Carl, look, we can't label you an alcoholic. That's something you're going to have to do yourself. That is true. It didn't help me a bit. Or they would say, well, Carl, it's not what you drink or how much you drink. It's what it does to you when you drink it. That is also true. Still didn't help me a bit. And this went on for 6 months. I'm going to 5, 6, 7 meetings a week. I am not drinking, but I am leaving those meetings, and I knew I'm missing out because there's a lot of people in there a lot happier than I was. And this went on for a long time, and my job allowed me to travel in those days. I had an occasion to be in Akron, Ohio. Now, this is in 1973. And while there, I went to an AA meeting. And while at this meeting, I met a lady who at that time had been sober in this program for 30 years. You know, you'd have to be too smart to figure out. She came in 1943. Program just started in 1935. I mean, she knew Bill Wilson. And she knew Dr. Bob Smith. You know, when they say Bill Wilson to me, I go, ooh, ooh. Dr. Bob, ooh, ooh. Now, I'm not saying that they don't deserve that respect, but to this old sister, there was no ooh-ooh. I mean, to this old sister, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson were just other drunks sitting at tables, hanging on with their fingernails like she was, trying to stay sober one more day. She knew many of the first 100 people whose stories appear in that big book. I thought, if there's anybody on the face of this earth can give me a definition of what an alcoholic is, this woman certainly ought to be able to do it. Didn't get a chance to ask her. Someone beat me to it. They said to her, how would you define an alcoholic? And the definition she gave that night has allowed me to freely admit the fact that I am an alcoholic, admit it and accept it from that day to this. You know what she said? She said, well, I'm an alcoholic because I can't guarantee my actions when I pick up a drink. I said, bingo, that's me. I mean, why didn't they know that in Detroit? I mean, it's a nice definition. It makes all the sense in the world. She didn't say anything about rope belts or tennis shoes or not working or skid row. Nothing. She said, I can't guarantee my actions when I pick up a drink. I said, oh boy, when did I get home with this story? It was true that night, and it remains true tonight. If I said to you, thank you for having me, but I'm not one of you, and on the way home I decide to get a little drink, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to get drunk tonight. But on the other hand, I can't guarantee it. If I pick up a drink tonight, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be drunk for the next 3 or 4 weeks the way it used to be. But on the other hand, I can't guarantee it. I simply cannot guarantee my actions when I pick up a drink. Now, I'm told in the United States, and I suppose that statistically the same thing would be true in Canada, I'm told in the United States, of the 250 million people in that country, approximately 150 million drink alcohol on a regular basis over the age of 15. They drink alcohol on a regular basis, and of that 150 million, probably 100 million or 120 million don't have any trouble with it at all. But there's a little pocket of them, about 15 million, who when they drink it, like me, it just ends in disaster. Well, I ask you tonight, what is the difference in the 135 million that seem to drink without problems and the 15 million like me when we drink it, somebody pays a big price. What is the difference? I mean, are the 135 million the good people? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Because if they are, that makes us the bad people. And I'm here to tell you, bad people don't put on affairs like we're having here tonight and sustain themselves for 50 years. I'll bring it in closer focus. I have a brother who is 3 years younger than I am. And I haven't heard people say, well, you just get that man or woman out of those environments that they're in, why, they'll be all right. Well, my brother and I are in the same environment. We had the same parents. We went to the same schools. And for all intents and purposes, we have lived the same kind of adult lives. Now, if you ask my brother to come over to your house and have a couple of drinks and dinner, that is exactly what will happen. He will come over, you will have a couple of drinks, and then you will have dinner. Now, if you ask me under those conditions, we may not have dinner at all. Or you may have dinner after you've invited me to go home. Or the third option is, I might pull it off. I might do it. History says, no, you wouldn't do it. History says you'd be face down on those mashed potatoes. Well, what's the difference in my brother and I then? What is the difference between the 100 million and the 10 million and my brother and myself? What is that difference? You told me what that difference was. Here it is. I have the disease of alcoholism and my brother doesn't have it. Just that simple. Now, I will confess to you that when you first told me this alcoholism was a disease, I didn't believe you. See, I wouldn't dare say that to you, John. But I didn't believe it. I said to myself, that's what those drunks tell each other to soothe their conscience.
Why, I have a disease. Whoa!
See, I believe in those days, if you didn't eat it, drink it, get it from the toilet seat, couldn't be a disease. I mean, it never occurred to me that it could just develop. Okay. In fact, I carry this with me. I'd like to read you. It's a little short excerpt from it. 19, he impressed me, so I kept it. Made a copy of it. Did you ever hear of a guy named Sidney Harris? He used to be a syndicated columnist in the Detroit Free Press. I'm sure you, well, he's been dead for a long time, but he wrote a column back in 1978. It impressed me so much, I'm still carrying it around with me. Now, and he's talking about disease. It's not talking about alcoholism, it's just disease. Okay? And this is what he says. Let me read a little bit. He says, we really haven't grasped the revolution in health and disease that has taken place within the 20th century. And we are still thinking of ailments and cures in terms that no longer apply. He says, diseases on the whole may be divided into two types, those that we get and those that we make. Those that we get attack or invade us from the outside, as it were. Those that we make are produced largely by our own actions, habits, and way of life. He says, the first type has largely been conquered through modern medicine, the plagues and pestilence and infections that used to kill and afflict us. We've done a great job of that. He says, but most 20th century diseases seem to be made by us rather than gotten from the outside. So when you told me that this was a disease, I said to myself, that is impossible. That is impossible. What we're talking about is an action. That is not a disease. That's an action, and you can teach a monkey to do that. But I tried for the next 2 years in this program to disprove that, and I failed at that too. Now, if we're going to talk about disease, we've got to define it. And I'm going to apologize to you. I'm not smart enough to give you a very fancy Latin punctuated definition of disease. Just don't possess that kind of ability. However, I did find a definition in Webster's Dictionary. I'd like to read it to you. So when I use the word disease, this is what I'm referring to. It's a four-part definition. Let me just read it. I'm going to talk about this disease. Now, alcoholism, just disease. Mr. Webster, number one, uneasiness, distress. Everybody, any of that in this room? Two, any departure from health, illness in general. And I suggest to you tonight that waking up in the morning and throwing up for 20 minutes is a departure from health. I don't think healthy people do it. And three, a particularly destructive process in the body with specific cause and characteristic symptoms, specific illness, ailment, malady. Now, if you're sitting at home in your easy chair after a three-week drunk, and out from under the couch crawls a spider about the size of a garbage can lid, I suggest to you that's an illness, ailment, malady, or a combination of all three. And three, four, an evil or destructive tendency or state of affairs. Now, let me repeat those without comment. Uneasiness, distress, any departure from health, illness in general, a particular destructive process in the body with specific cause and characteristic symptoms, specific illness, ailment, malady, an evil or destructive tendency or state of affairs. I suggest to you tonight, folks, Mr. Webster has just defined cancer. He's just defined heart disease. He has just defined diabetes. He has just defined alcoholism. Now, you told me that my disease was incurable. And it is. And it is. If I have the good fortune to live another 20 years, 25 years, I'm going to die with alcoholism. However, if I have the good judgment to stay with you, I'm not going to die of alcoholism. And there's a big difference. Now, the fact that it is incurable, does that make it unique? No, it doesn't. In a room this size, statistically speaking, we probably have 25 diabetics in this room. Your disease isn't curable either, but you can live a happy, healthy, productive life provided you do certain things. The same with my disease. I can live a happy, healthy, productive life provided I do certain things. And my group said to me when I first got there, they said, Carl, can you go one day without a drink? And I said, I don't know. But it had been a long time. They said, if you will come to this meeting, we will teach you how to go one day without a drink. And once you master that, then we can start treating your disease. And pretty soon the drinking will go away. So it is incurable. And you also told me that my disease is progressive. Now, what does that mean? Well, Mr. Webster says progressive simply means becoming more severe and spreading to other parts. That's all, nothing else. And I'm going to tell you now, if my alcoholism never got any worse than an upset stomach and a headache, I never would have needed you. Why? Because I know how to deal with an upset stomach, and I know how to deal with a headache. What I don't know how to deal with is the guilt and the remorse and the self-hate and the loathing and all of those negative emotions that are inherent with my disease. The big book again says it better than I can say it. What does the big book call them? The hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Now let me tell you something. When those four guys move in the neighborhood, you either better get to AA quickly or rent a room with that thick wallpaper. Because you're going to lose that battle. Now, like any other disease, it will progress faster in some of us and slower in others. My sponsor told me this, and I believe him. He said that when he took his first drink, from that time until he found this program, his life was just a mess. And I believe them, and I believe there are a lot of people like that. However, I think there are probably a lot more people like me. I drank for 25 years. And the first 15 years that I drank, I didn't have any trouble with alcohol. Occasionally, I might drink a little too much, but it didn't interfere with my being a father, or a husband, or an employee, or a citizen. I functioned very, very well those first 15 years. The last 10 years were just full of problems. The last 5 years was chaos. And the last 2 years that I drank was purely pathological. I'm drinking simply to function. And if someone would have said to me, "Carl, what awful thing happened to you that made your drinking pattern change so dramatically? You must have endured some tragedy." No. "Well, did your wife die?" No. "Then your children, they're ill." No. "Did you lose your job?" No. "What happened?" "I don't know." Now I know what happened. I learned from you what happened. I developed the disease of alcoholism, and it progressed in my life. That's what happened. That's what happened. So it's incurable, and it's progressive. Now, I'm not going to go into a long drunkologue, but I think it's important to show the progression. That's almost killed me. You know, I've done a lot over the last 23 years, I talked to a lot of smart people about this, and I can't find any difference in the disease of alcoholism than any other disease, except maybe one difference, and that's this. The sicker we get with this disease, the better off we think we are. It's the only disease I know of that's that crazy. I took my first drink, I don't know when it was. I really and truly don't know because it was a non-event. 14, 15, that's the way it was, you know. And it was that way for the next 4 or 5 years. If we had booze, we drank it. If we didn't have it, we didn't miss it. It was not a big thing. Then about 21, 22 years old, the drinking started to do more. Now, I don't know whether it was early signs of the disease. I don't know, or I don't know if it's the kind of life we were living at the time. Newly married, have a house full of kids, flat broke, don't have a dime. And our entire social life, it's made up of people just like ourselves. And every 5 or 6 weeks, a group of us would get together, 4 or 5 couples, and have a lovely, lovely party. The guys would bring what they want to drink. The girls would bring casseroles and things. Wonderful time. And I remember looking back on those parties. Every single party, I would simply get drunk. I don't mean drunk. I mean drunk. See, if you've been drunk, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, don't worry. If you're drinking, it'll happen. I would just get drunk. Oh, wow. You know, and I'd say to my wife things like, "Honey, we gotta stop going to those parties." And she'd say, "Why?" And I'd say, "We're drinking too much." She'd say, "No, we are not drinking too much." Then I'd go into some long tirade about how it wasn't my fault. I mean, Earl was there. He drank drink for drink. He says, "That's correct. That was last time. This party you drank up Paul. Next party you drank up Fritz. And they'd come one time, dance, no more." I would do it every time. And then the periods, as you know, this is the old graph. I'm going to cover this quickly. The periods of not drinking got shorter. Then the periods of drinking got longer. Then you start having little cute little things happen to you. Like a little blackout. You lose all of Wednesday or something. I've lost so much time, I wish I could write a book. I don't know what happened in this, but I've lost 2 hours. You know, just lose it. As I'm sure you have. And this worried me for a while, man. And when I started having these blackouts, this worried me because I wasn't used to that. You know, I wasn't used to that. I remember that Fridays were a bad, bad time at our house. I would call my wife from the office and I would say to her, honey, I'm going to leave now. It's 5 o'clock and I'm going to be home about 7. Would you hold dinner? She said, yeah, sure. Nice lady. She'd hold dinner. Well, when 7 rolled around, I didn't feel like I felt at 5. Next thing I know, it's 3 in the morning. They're turning the lights on, telling me to go home. After this happens 40 or 50 times, she says to me, why do you do that? You know, not why do you drink? Why do you call me up? I mean, she said, you call me every Friday, and you say you'll be home at 7. You've never been home at 7. She says, what, next week, don't do that. Don't go by the phone. Just go from the office to the saloon, get drunk, come home at 3. Don't go by the phone. Call me. Well, you know, you gotta get, and you have a lot of reasons for that, don't you? I had customers. I had school chums. I had this. I had that. That's a good question. Why do you do it? And when you start to recognize what the really answer is, it's a terrifying answer. Why do you do it? The answer is, I don't know. I simply don't know. Because when I called her, my intention was to be home at 7. I haven't had the drink yet, had I? Uh-huh. See, if someone would have came in at that time and said to me, Carl, look at this. You're a fine guy. You were a fine guy at the parties. But you take a couple of drinks, and you just get crazy. I'd say, now, wait a minute. You don't see a rope belt and tennis shoes on me, do you? Or a long coat. Look at me. I'm a nice guy. Yes, I know this is a problem. This is going to pass. No, don't you insinuate that I can't control this stuff. My friend. And I can say that honestly, all the years I drank, I can never, ever remember saying I'm going out and get drunk tonight. Never said it. Never intended to. Never intended to get arrested. Never intended to go to jail. Then the blackouts, they say, coming. And when this happened a few times, I wanted to get some advice on this because I was worried about it. I was losing too much time. So the guy I selected, and I selected him very carefully, was a guy, a bartender, at the saloon I did a lot of my drinking. Now, why did I pick him? I thought I used some good sense. I picked him because I said, look, he serves this to all kinds of people, men, women, young, old, fat, thin, black, white, and he must have a lot of experience watching different people drink and what it does to them. He's got to have a lot of data. So I went to him and I said, John, I remember leaving here last night at 3 in the morning. I don't remember another thing until I came to this morning about 6 o'clock. He said, don't you worry about that. Happens to me all the time. Great guy. Picked the right guy. However, he's a good friend and remains a good friend to this day. And he came back in about 15 minutes. He knew I was worried. And he said to me, Carl, do you think you have a drinking problem? I said, John, I don't know. He said, tell me this. I said, here it comes. Here comes the question. Here comes the question. He says, tell me this. You drink in the mornings? At that time, I didn't. I said, no, I don't drink in the morning. I don't drink in the morning. I can't drink in the mornings, for God's sake. I'm sick in the morning. Can't drink in the mornings. I mean, fools drink in the morning. See, the minute he said morning drink, our office was in Allen Park, Michigan. It's a suburb of Detroit. I don't know if some of you may know where it is. And I would come down Outer Drive to my office about 6:30 on those mornings I would go to work. And I would go by this bar, and occasionally, not every morning, but some mornings I would see these alcoholics out there waiting for this guy to open up the saloon. And they had on rope belts, these guys, and you know, tennis shoes. And the minute he said morning drink, that's the picture that flashed in my mind. And I said, no, I don't drink. No, I don't drink in the morning. I will never drink in the mornings. He said, good, because alcoholics drink in the mornings. So I left here at 3 o'clock, drunk as $1,700. Comfortable knowledge. Oh, don't worry about the blackouts. Hell, we're all having those. And as long as I don't drink in the mornings, I got nothing to worry about. Well, about 2 years now to the day after I made that I will never drink in the morning speech, I've been gone from home on this particular drive. I've been gone for 4 days. Wife didn't know where I was. I don't know where I was, frankly. I mean, to this day, I'm not sure. I knew some spots I remember, some I don't. But I do know this. I had on the same suit for 4 days. And I knew I hadn't shaved for 4 days. And I knew I hadn't bathed for 4 days. And I'm sitting in a Carter's... You have them up here, Carter's Hamburger Joints? Good, good. I'll tell you. If anyone comes to town with that story about... run them out. Because I wound up, after this 4 day drunk, I wound up in this Carter's Hamburger... Let me describe it to you. It's a little white building. And all they have is stools in there. And they serve, allegedly, hamburgers. Now this is, I'm there, I've been going home 4 days now, just a mess, and here a short 2 years before, I wasn't going to drink in the morning, never, ever, ever going to drink in the morning, but this morning I'm going to have a drink. But I have a good reason. You tell me if this is not a good reason. If I don't get a drink and get it quickly, I'm going to die. And it isn't, well, I think I might die. You know damn well you're going. And you want to know insanity? Huh? I'm sitting on a little, I said, you can't die here, Carl. You can't die here. What will they tell your kids? Can you hear it? How'd your father die, Joe? I don't know. He couldn't get a drink. He died. You see, if somebody would have walked into Carter's that morning at 6:30, because the saloon didn't open, and ironically, it's the same saloon that I passed going to my office. And it didn't open for a half hour, but if it opened at 7, and I'm here at 6:30 shaking, wasn't that place to open? If someone would have walked in that morning and said to me, Carl, look at you. You've been gone from home for 4 days. Your wife is worried sick. Your boss is threatening to fire you. Your kids are worried to death. You look like you're a disgrace to the race. I would have said, wait a minute, time out. You don't see tennis shoes and a rope belt on me. Yes, I know this looks bad, but it's a temporary thing. I will get through this, and I will never do this again. So don't you suggest that I can't control it. Yes, it got out of hand this once. So at 7 o'clock, I walked across the street, and guess who's there? The three alcoholics. So me and the three alcoholics go in that saloon. At 7 o'clock in the morning, and we all did precisely the same thing. Four lives were saved in Lum's Bar that morning in Allen Park, Michigan. That's the closest thing to a spiritual experience I've ever had. And after you take a couple, finding one will stay down, and you know you're not going to die that morning. I mean, the fear just leaves you. You know, you may die eventually, of course, but not this morning. You know, so you take a couple more, and you stop perspiring and stop shaking, and feel pretty good. Got through that crisis. Looked at that mirror and saw me and these three alcoholics there. I said to myself, I remember this like it happened today. Said to myself, Carl, Carl, Carl. You got to get a hold of yourself, or you're going to wind up with a problem. Is that insanity or what? So that morning in Lum's Bar, 1973, in Allen Park, Michigan, Carl and Isaac quit drinking forever. In fact, I told the bartender, give me a double because this is my last one. I'm just drunk enough to be obnoxious. I'm standing there holding a drink, and I look at these three alcoholics standing beside me and says, boys, I tell you, you better get a hold of yourself and follow my example because I'm never going to touch this stuff again. They looked at me like, go ahead, do whatever you have to do. We're busy saving our own lives here. Right now, the wife's at work, the kids are at school, I down the double, I walked out, and I'm never, ever, ever going to drink again, ever. Went home, and I'm halfway through the shower, and I start to shake again. So I said to myself, now look, Carl, quitting's a great idea. Really is, and you should do it in time. You should do it. But let's not be silly. I said, if you just stop dead, you're going to go be like you were in Carter's this morning. You're flirting with death there. You're flirting with death. Why don't we just taper off? I said, good idea. Taper off makes a lot of sense to me. So we tapered off and back on, and I repeat that scenario over and over and over again. Well, why couldn't I stop? Why couldn't I stop? Did I have a desire to stop? You betcha. You betcha. Yes, I did. I sure did. I want it with all my heart not to be able to drink. Why? Because I have incentive? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sure did. I sure did. My wife said to me, if you don't straighten up and take these babies and leave you, I didn't want that to happen. My boss said to me, if I bail you out of jail one more time, I'm going to fire you. I didn't want that to happen either. So I had incentive. Did I have a desire? Oh, I had a burning desire. Because I hated the way I felt. I hated the way my children ran from me. I hated walking around feeling sick and tired every day. So I had desire and I had incentive. Well, why couldn't I quit? What does it say in the 11th step of this program? I sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. The two things I lacked was knowledge and power. Lacked those two things. Didn't have those. People that loved me were trying to help me. And I'm going to tell you guys, if love could fix what we have, we wouldn't be here tonight. If the doctors could fix what we have, we would not be here tonight. My brother, God love my brother. I mean, he's a wonderful man. I've made no progress in this part of my life. My brother is a boy, I'll tell you, when he has a drink, he has a drink. That's it. He's the kind of guy somebody can do. He can sip a drink. See, that's sick. And he does it to me every Christmas. He'll come to our house and once I turn to host, and I say, would you like a drink, Irv? And he'll think it over. And he'll say, yeah. I give him a drink, and he'll sit there and sip it. Takes him an hour sometimes to drink a drink. Isn't that crazy? Huh? And, you know, and here I am. I've been sober 23 years. I'm looking. I want to say, I don't, thank God. I want to say, drink it. Drink it. But here's a man that's telling me, he said, if it does to me what it's doing to you, I wouldn't drink it. Hell yes! People are saying, if you just loved your kids more, you wouldn't do this. It's not about loving my kids, you jerk. I mean, our father passed away. My brother lives in Akron. He said, that's where I grew up. You know, that's where he started. And our father passed away a few years ago, and I was down there when my brother came home from work. And he walked in the door, and he said, oh, he says, I need a drink. I said, you don't need a drink. You're not even shaking. He said, well, I want a drink. I said, well, that's a hell of a difference. That's embarrassing, isn't it? I haven't made any progress there at all. But the point I'm making is that what's the best thing to tell a drunk? Don't drink. Don't drink. That's the best advice to give them. Helen, everyone was giving me that advice, and I'm sure they were giving it to you, too. You see, everything that I have in the world today I owe to AA. I really do. But my chief indebtedness to you is this. You allowed me to take my condition up out of the moral arena, dust off all of the old superstitions, the misinformation, and look it dead in the eye for what it is. It is an incurable, progressive, a treatable disease. You see, I believe we are not bad people trying to be good people. That's not what we're about. We are sick people trying to be well people. There's a big difference there. I went to every church in Detroit. No reflection on the churches. I went to fortune tellers. I went to halfway houses. I went to treatment centers. I touched every base in town. I went to the doctor. My doctor, a very good physical man, and he said to me, "What's wrong?" I said, "I'm nervous." And he took a blood pressure. "Yeah, blood pressure's high." And I said, "My ulcer hurts." "Oh, yeah." So he gave me some Maalox and put me on a diet. And he said to me, "Do you drink much?" I said, "Not much." Jack Sitzler, don't ever ask us if we drink much. Now, and it's not that we will lie to you. That's not the issue. We don't know what much is. What the hell is much? We don't know much. We don't know much. If you say you drink a fifth, we'll say, yeah. Drink two, no. Drink one, though. But if you say you drink much, I can guarantee you the answer. And that's what I gave. And he said to me, "Look, so what you got to do is slow down. Relax." I went out, slowed down, relaxed the only way I knew how. Now, am I following my doctor? No, I am not. Here's a man who is expert in one phase of my disease. Now, you told me my disease will attack me three ways: physically, mentally, spiritually. And I must treat all three phases of it. And here I'm asking a man who is expert in one, the physical aspects he can treat. He knows how to treat it. He can't treat the spiritual and he can't treat the mental. I mean, those of us who have been in hospitals, we go into a hospital, aren't we a mess? I mean, our eyes are red, we're shaking, we can't stand up, can't sit down, can't eat, can't not eat, can't do anything. They keep us in there for a couple of weeks and our eyes clear up. And pretty soon we can hold food down. A couple of weeks, feel good. And they discharge us. If this disease were purely physical, at that point we'd be pronounced cured, wouldn't we? But what happens? We go out and say, "Carl, where you been?" "Been in the hospital." "You don't look sick." "Don't feel sick." "Let's have a drink." "Okay." I'm back in there again. So I said to myself, "Carl, the only thing's wrong with you is you're insane. You're mad." And I'm sure the diagnosis was correct. But I don't know about up here, but in the state of Michigan, you can't declare yourself crazy. You try it and see what happens. But if you're downtown raising hell and the cop comes over and you say to him, "I'm crazy," they'll take you to jail. However, if you have a piece of paper that says you're crazy, they'll take you to the hospital. And I set out to get a piece of paper that said I was crazy. Bennington. I figured I'll go out here. In those days, they had Michigan Avenue was open, the old hospital out there on Michigan Avenue. Wayne County General. I go out there and do some baskets, some clay, make some pots, a couple of finger paintings, get that paper, get the hell out of there. But I was going to do it right. I was going to do it like some drunk. I went to this psychiatrist. I'm going to go in the front door, not crawl in the back door. So I went to the psychiatrist. I went to him for 8 Wednesdays. It would go like this. I'd walk in, we'd shake hands, sit down, he'd get out the yellow tablet, and I'd start talking. Then he'd say, "Ooh, time's up." Then I'd give him a check. He said, "See you next week." Now I'd go. That went on for 8 Wednesdays. The last Wednesday I'm in there, I'm blaming somebody for something. Now the clear blue sky says to me, "Do you drink much?" And I gave him the same answer I gave the other guy. "Not much." He was a little more perceptive than the medical man. And he said to me, here's exactly how the exchange went. He said, "Do you drink much?" I said, "Not much." He says, "Let's try antabuse." I didn't know what it was in those days. I said to him, "What's antabuse?" "Oh," he says, "antabuse is a medication I'm going to give you, then when you drink, you'll get sick." At that moment, I knew I wasn't crazy. And I told him, I said, "I'm not crazy. You are crazy. I am not crazy." I said, "I've been coming here for 8 weeks telling you all of this secret stuff, and all you can come up with, Jacko, is medicine that will make me sick when I drink." "Oh," I says, "you're a joke. I don't need your medicine to make me sick when I drink." "I'm so sick when I drink now. What the hell do you think? I came here in the first place. If I wasn't getting sick when I drink, jerk, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I said, I'm leaving here and I'm never coming back. And I've left and I've never been back. Now, am I falling the psychiatrist? No, no, no. He probably knew what was wrong with me 10 minutes after I'm in there on the first visit. Well, why didn't he say to me, Carl, look, you're not crazy, but you do have the disease of alcoholism. Go to AA and get your life straightened out. You know what? I would have made the rope belt speech to him too, wouldn't I? Damn, bet you I would, you know. So see, it isn't important that you know I'm an alcoholic. That doesn't matter a bit. It's vital that I know it, and it's very important that I understand what I'm saying when I say I'm an alcoholic. Can't guarantee my actions. That's all I'm saying. So I went home and I told my wife, I said, you know what that quack said to me today? She said, no. I says, he insulted me. And she kind of chuckled at that. I says, he implied that I can't stop drinking. He wanted to give me medicine. And I says, I can quit anytime I want to. Hemorrhaging at the larynx. Shaking. I can quit anytime I want to. I told her, I'm not going to take a drink for 30 days. The minute I said 30 days, I would have paid $1,000 to have 30 days back. That was a big overkill. I could have told that woman a week. And she would have danced in the streets. But I said 30 days. And you don't want to know something? Here's the irony. I did it. I went 30 days without a drink, and I'm here to tell you that's the worst 30 days of my life, drunk or sober. Quitting almost killed me. I do not recommend quitting. Quitting is dangerous. I recommend stopping and staying stopped. That's what I recommend. Don't you do crazy things when you're on the wagon. Yeah, I mean, you see people you hardly know, almost strangers, and you give them an update on how drunk you are. You know, how long have you been since you had a drink? It's been 4 days. I've been 4 days. Why'd they care? You know, pretty soon they're crossing the street, they see you coming. They don't want an update on how long you've been out for that. Well, okay. I remember my mother, may she rest in peace, she passed away. She lived to be 96 years old. I remember during this period, I said to her something. I said, you know something, Ma? I said, I've been 14 days without a drink. She said, big deal, I've been 58 years without a drink. So I got 30 days. You know, I proved to myself that I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't. And I picked up a drink. It was January 2nd or 3rd, 1973, and I was drunk until July the 11th. I wasn't drunk, but I was drunk. Until July the 11th. Why'd I come to you? Quite honestly, I came to you because I ran out of places to go. And my disease had then progressed to a point where dying seemed like a real good idea. Now, don't hold up your hands, but how many people in this room that have what I have ever thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice just to go to sleep tonight and never wake up again? I'll tell you, folks, that's sick. I'm told that in the United States, I assume it's true in Canada, 33% of all the suicides in our country are people like us. Now, they're not killing themselves because they're bad people. They're killing themselves because they're sick people. So don't you tell me this is not a disease. 40% of all the beds in the state mental institutions in the United States are full of people like us. Now, we're not in those institutions because we're bad. We're in there because we're sick. So don't tell me this is not a disease. And I was going to get a rubber hose put on the back of my car, drive out to Kensington Park, which is a little bit west of Detroit, put it in the back window and turn on the engine, because I'd been every place, I'd tried everything. I'd been to doctors, I'd been to psychiatrists, I'd been to priests, I'd been to churches, I'd been to love-ins and hug-ins and schmug-ins. I'd been everywhere and nothing was working, and I had to end this suffering. I had to end this guilt. I had to end this remorse. I had to end it. And before I did that, though, I heard of AA. I didn't know anybody in AA. And I heard you had success with people that drank too much. And I called downtown, and they said, there's a meeting in East Dearborn tonight. In fact, it's about an hour from now. Get over there. They gave me the address, and I went over to AA, not knowing what to expect. I didn't know what went on with these programs. I walked in the first door, and the guy that shook my hand is a guy named Joe Boucher. He's dead now, so he won't mind my using his name. And he said, I told him this is my first meeting. Like I had to tell him. Like he didn't know. You know. I mean, hell, I couldn't have been to many. You know. And he says, come on with me. And he took me and set me down right where this lady sat in the front and gave me some coffee. He didn't say, if you loved your kids more, you wouldn't do it. He didn't say to me, well, if it was doing to you what it's doing to me, I wouldn't drink it. He didn't say any of those things. He just said, sit down here, get some coffee. He said to me, you ever been to an open meeting? I said, hell, I don't know. I said, what's an open meeting? He said, the man's going to get up and talk here in a minute. I just said, you'll be okay. And the guy got up to speak. That's what he said. This sentence began, a very good friend of mine, he said, opening remarks, he says, my name is Dave, and I'm happy I didn't throw up this morning. My ears went, ba-da-bam. See, if he didn't talk to me about the steps and the promises and the, well, I would have missed it. I was too sick to listen. But I knew throwing up that here's a guy that doesn't do it anymore. I got to try my best to listen to him. Don't remember much about that meeting, but after it was over, it felt good. I knew I was in the right place. I knew I was in the right place. And after it's over, I've been in the program now about 45 minutes. And old Tom Pennington, another saint, has gone to his reward. He came over, retired police officer, this big, great big voice. And he had with him a directory. They walked over and he said, you know where this church is? This is Thursday night. And I said, yes. And he said, go there tomorrow. Do a circle around it. And he went to the next day. He said, you know where that is? And I said, mm-hmm. He said, go there then. Went through the whole week. He would affirm that I knew where it was. And once I said, yeah, I did, he said, go there. Now he said, something else I want you to do. So I want you to ask for help in the morning, give some thanks at night, and go to that meeting I circled. I said to him, I'll be happy to go to that meeting, sir. But I don't believe in that other stuff. He said, I don't recall asking you if you believed it. I've been in the program now about an hour. He said, it's pretty apparent to me what you believe in. This is not an option list. It's not menus. This is what you do. I said, okay. And I remember I went to the meetings we had circled in the book. I remember after the sixth one, I remember coming home, John. It dawned on me I'd gone 6 days without a drink, and I hadn't quit or anything. Just happened. It's a miracle. Just a miracle. And you know what? Nobody, when I sat at those tables, nobody said to me, well, if you just loved your kids more, or if it was doing to me what it's doing to you, all they did was tell me about them. That's all. And it's worked. Been that way for the last 23 years. Ask for help. Give a little thanks. Go to the meeting and got circled. I took out the book with the circles. I'm going to close with a story I stole. But first, before I do that, some of you may have read this, but I read in the, as Bill sees it, an account of when the last time that Bill Wilson and Bob Smith spoke to one another. I don't know if you've read that or not. But the situation is this. Now, this is like they've known each other 20 years. They've seen AA grow from them to what it is. And Bill writes about the last time he saw Bob, and they were in the hospital, and Bob is very, very sick. And if I may, I'd like to just read that little, very, very short. He said, I took my leave of Dr. Bob, knowing that he was to undergo a serious operation. The old broad smile was on his face, and he said almost jokingly, remember, Bill, let's not louse this thing up. Let's keep it simple. I turned away, unable to say a word, and that's the last time I ever saw him. The last words out of Dr. Bob's mouth to Bill Wilson's ears was, remember, Bill, don't louse this thing up. Keep it simple. Because I'm going in there and I may not come out. And he didn't. He didn't come out. And you're going to be by yourself. Now, don't you get in the way of this program. You don't have to do anything spectacular, Bill. All you have to do is take those folks to a meeting and stick their feet under that table and let the program work its magic. Keep it simple. Tell them to ask for help and to give some thanks and to go to the meeting that's circled. That's all you have to do, Bill. Bill Joy, and some of you know, told me this story when I first came in the program, and I loved it. I loved to close with it. Bill says that since man squeezed the first grape and made the first glass of wine, there have been alcoholics like us. They squeezed it, made one glass. Someone like us came along, drank it, punched him in the nose because it wouldn't anymore. And from that day to this, alcoholics have been roaming the globe. Bill says one day God's in heaven, and he's very upset, sitting by himself. And he said, I don't know what to do with these drunks, God says. God says, I've given them everything I can think of. He says, I've given them loving spouses. I've given them scientists. I've given them clergymen. I've given them doctors. I've given them philosophers. I've given them psychiatrists. God says, well, what do the drunks do? They make the spouses crazy. They make the doctors crazy. They make the psychiatrists crazy. God says, these drunks are making me crazy. Then God says, wait a minute. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to take these drunks, put them in a sack, and make them take care of themselves. So 1935 in Akron, the first sack opened and two guys jumped in. Bill Wilson and Bob Smith. And pretty soon there was a third and a fifth and then a sack in New York and one in Cleveland and one in Toronto and one in Denver and Atlanta. And sacks are opening up all over the world and people are just pouring in them sacks. And every once in a while one of us will try to crawl out of the sack and we'll say, no, no, no. You have to stay right here. Because you can't make it out of this sack. I just want to thank you all for having me here tonight in your sack that's been open for 50 years. Thank you all.